Most of this we've done in Hinduism 1, but these are kind of the broad textual sources that we've looked at. And in the previous weeks of this term, we've been looking at traditions, particularly the Vedanta tradition, that engages with these texts. And so we have the, just to give you a little orientation for those of you who are lost in all these names. So we have the texts are divided in Shruti and Smriti. That's kind of the basic category. Shruti, that which is heard. Smriti, that which is remembered. These are dependent for their authority on the Shruti text. These Shruti texts are believed to be divinely revealed or eternal in non-theistic traditions. And the Smriti texts are seen to be written by specific sages at particular times. And so these have a beginning, these have no beginning. That's how traditionally they're seen. And we've kind of looked at the Vedanta, well, we've looked at the Vedanta traditions, and the Vedanta traditions are traditions that privilege certain of these texts. They privilege the Upanishads, which are seen as the Vedanta, as the final words of the Vedas. That's as good as it gets. But then they also draw on the Bhagavad Gita here, which is a part of the Mahabharata, which the Mahabharata claims itself to be the fifth Veda, so it's the Upanishad of the fifth Veda. And then you have the Brahma Sutras, which is a text that's attempting to make sense of the Upanishads and tell you how you should read them, how you should interpret them, and what the theology of the Upanishads is. And so this we've seen is the foundation for Vedanta traditions. Shankara writes commentaries on these texts. Ramanuja writes commentaries on these texts. Madhva writes commentaries on these texts, cites these texts profusely in their works. And this is the foundation for their entire theology. We've seen for Ramanuja, the Puranas were important as well, as well as the Itihasa, the Mahabharata and Ramayana. And for Madhva, similarly, he also engages with those texts. There was one other corpus of text we've seen that didn't quite fit into this, and those were the Pancharatra texts. And the Pancharatra texts, we've seen they're texts that mostly are important for the ritual practices that they teach. These are Vaishnava texts, so these are texts that deal with the worship of Vishnu. And both, if you remember, Ramanuja attached a lot of importance to this. The guru of Ramanuja's guru wrote a whole text on the Pancharatras, defending their validity. Madhva himself draws extensively on these texts as well. But these are a different... these are not part of Shruti or Smriti, but these are tantric texts. And I've mentioned something briefly about tantric texts in previous weeks, but today I want to spend a bit more time on them and look at the nature of these texts. And they're less less pervasive, in a sense, in Hindu thought generally. Tantric texts are texts that are generally accepted within certain traditions or within certain group of traditions as authoritative, but are not sort of seen as authoritative in the broader scheme. They don't fit in the Shruti and Smriti division either, in that they're believed to be revealed at a particular time. And so like the Smriti text, they sort of have an origin there. There's a time when at which these texts sort of emerge. But the traditions that care about the tantric text will claim that these texts are not of human origin, but are rather revealed by the deity that is the focus of these texts. And so the Vaishnavas like Madhva and Ramanuja will argue that the Pancharatra texts, the Vaishnava tantric texts, are revealed by Vishnu to his devotees as a way of teaching how he should be worshipped. These texts do contain theology as well. The Pancharatra texts contain a lot of theology, that they draw on to some degree. And it's kind of the theology that forms, that really makes them, if you want, sort of sectarian, that makes them important for specific traditions. Shankara, for example, who, like Ramanuja and Madhva, is a Vedantist, rejects the authority of the Panchatantra text because he argues the theology that they teach conflicts with the theology of the Vedanta, of the Upanishads, and therefore they have no authority. And so these tantric texts are more contested in their authority, but they're immensely important for the development of these traditions, particularly for their ritual practice. As I mentioned, most of the temples of Ramanuja and Madhva's tradition, the rituals in the temples are based on Panchatantra texts, and the initiation that they take into these traditions are Panchatantra-based initiations and so on. And so the tantric texts are much broader than just the Panchatantra texts that we've seen. And they're important for Shaiva traditions, which we'll look at today, because Shaiva traditions have their own tantric texts, variously called, but often kind of grouped together as agamas. These are texts that the Shaivas believe to be revealed by Shiva himself, and to they advocate the worship of Shiva. But unlike the Vaishnavas, who accept the authority of their own tantric texts, the Panchatantra texts, the Vaishnavas claim that these texts are complementary to the Vedic revelation. And so we have, if you think, so this is the prime for Vaishnavas. This is the primary revelation, and the Upanishads give the final words on the Vedas. These texts here elaborate on the teachings of the Veda and are merely helping us to understand what these texts are saying, what the Upanishads are saying. And the Vaishnavas then say, well, what you have here in terms of the practice that is taught there, as well as the theology that is taught, that is complementary to these texts. And so Shankara argued the two are contradictory, they cannot go together. The Vaishnavas argue, no, they are complementary. They merely elaborate on certain things that are hinted at in the Upanishads, or they teach a ritual practice that is different from Vedic rituals, but is complementary to it, and is something that can pursue it alongside of it, or is, depending on which Vaishnavas you're talking about, or is merely a separate independent tradition that does not contradict the authority of the Vedas. That's the way the Vaishnavas see it. Yamuna, Ramanuja's sort of a great grand teacher, the teacher of his teacher, writes this whole book on the Panchatantras, defending the validity of it, and this is basically his argument. They're merely complementary. They elaborate more on things not found here. They do not put these texts down. They're merely sort of complementary to them. They're not higher. They're not lower. They're equal in importance. The Shaivas, on the other hand, as we will see, have a very different view of their own tantric texts. And the Shaivas see the agamas, their tantric texts, as either superior to them, superior to the Vedic revelation and everything that's on this side of the board, or as and therefore as it's either superior or in the sense that you don't have to care about these texts, or it's complementary and you can follow the Vedic tradition alongside the Agama text, but the Agamas are still superior. So in any case, it's always a superior position they take. The Shaiva path taught by these texts is a higher path than what is taught here. And this becomes the main source for Shaiva theology, for the traditions that focus on the worship of Shiva, that see Shiva as supreme. And so if you sort of look at this, the Vaishnava traditions kind of see themselves as really representing everything here, but having a privileged understanding of what these texts are about. the ritualist Kheravati, these texts and these texts here, and argue that this is what the Vedas really teach about. The Vedanta traditions and specifically the Vaishnava Vedanta traditions kind of argue that, well, this is the final word of this. This is the ultimate reading of these and these texts. And we belong to the Vedic tradition, but we have a privileged understanding that those rituals don't have. That's the way the Vaishnavas see themselves. As Alexis Anderson, who for many years taught here in Oxford and was the world's greatest authority on Shaiva traditions, as he liked to put it, the Vaishnavas consider themselves privileged insiders of the Vedic tradition. The Shaivas consider themselves outsiders of the Vedic tradition. And this is really, this is in a sense something that goes back a very long time, but it explains why, as we will see, the Shaivas, at least initially, do not engage with Vedanta. Vedanta has for centuries been a Vaishnava enterprise. It's the Vaishnava area for theology. Shankara, of course, is theologically not a Vaishnava, but several scholars have argued that, culturally speaking, he clearly comes out of a Vaishnava milieu and is culturally speaking a Vaishnava that sort of moves into a different direction theologically. But the Shaivas don't engage with this. The Shaivas of the six darshanas, if you remember from the end of last term and beginning of this term, the Shaivas will not go to Mimamsa or Vedanta, but they will go to Nyaya and Vaisheshika. That's kind of these two schools. You see kind of Shaivas engaging it and not Vaishnavas. It's a school of logic that attempts to prove the existence of God and the existence of the self through logic rather than revelation. That's where the Shaivas will go until you have the emergence of the Agamas, and then the Shaivas will engage with those texts as their principal source for theology. And in a sense, this positioning of the Shaivas as outsiders is very much reflected in the, in a sense you can argue, goes back to the Vedic texts themselves. And if you look on the handout, you have at the beginning there, you have two passages from the Rig Veda. One is a hymn to Vishnu, the other one is a hymn to Rudra, who is basically to simplify things, is the Vedic form of Shiva. And both Vishnu and Rudra are mentioned about, or have about the same number of hymns devoted to them. Of 1,028 hymns that are in the Rig Veda, there's six that are devoted to Vishnu and about the same number to Rudra. So they're not very important deities in sort of the ritual worship of the Vedas. But they both have a very unique position in these texts. And we've talked already about Vishnu's position there. But just to recap, Vishnu is basically in the if you read that hymn to the from the Rig Veda to Vishnu, he's portrayed as a powerful deity who's an ally of Indra, who's the king of the gods and the main deity that is worshipped in the Rig Veda, who's benevolent to those who perform Vedic rituals. And by the time of the Brahmana text, the supplements to the Vedic text, Vishnu is repeatedly identified with Yajna itself, with sacrifice itself. And so he's very kind of, even though he's not that prominent in these texts, he's very central to the way the Vedic texts see the sort of their own practice, the practice of yajna, of ritual. Rudra, on the other hand, is a very different deity. He's very powerful. He is praised greatly in several hymns in the Rig Veda. But there's something else that comes in, and I just want to read a few verses from this hymn to Rudra, which I think will illustrate the point quite well. And so if you look at this hymn to Rudra, it starts there: "To the strong Rudra bring we these our songs of praise, to him the Lord of heroes with the braided hair, with the matted hair, that it be well with all our cattle and our men, that in this village all be healthy and well fed. Be gracious unto us, O Rudra, bring us joy. Lord of heroes, you with reverence will we serve. This is Rolf Griffith's translation, which is about 100 years old, so it's slightly archaic, but it brings out the flavor of the text quite nicely. Whatever health and strength our father Manu won by sacrifice, may we under your guidance gain. So Manu is the father of mankind. And then it kind of goes on praising the power of Rudra and, you know, asking him for his blessings, for his grace, and so on. And then about halfway through the hymn, the tone drastically changes. And if you look to the second column, the first hymn there, it says, O Rudra, harm not either great or small of us, harm not the growing boy, harm not the full-grown man. Slay not a sire among us, slay no mother here, and to our own dear bodies, Rudra, do no harm. Harm is not, Rudra, in our seed and progeny, harm is not in the living, nor in cows or steeds. Slay not our heroes in the fury of your wrath. Bringing oblations evermore, we call to you. Even as a herdsman, I have brought thee hymns of praise, O father of the Maruts, which are the storm gods, who are closely associated with Rudra in the Vedic text. Give us happiness. Blessed is your most favoring benevolence, so verily do we desire your saving help. Anyway, it goes on like that. And so you can see the tone really shifts, and it's Rudra is this powerful deity who's kind, and you ask him for his blessings and for his grace and so on. And at the same time, you kind of ask him, please, you know, stay away from us. Please do not kill us. Please do not kill our mother. Do not kill our cows. Do us no harm. And so it's a fickle deity. It's a deity who's powerful, but unlike Vishnu, who's powerful as well, Vishnu you want to be close to if you're a performer of Vedic rituals. Rudra you kind of want to keep at a distance. And you want to sort of appease him and keep him happy, but don't get too close to him. And this is reflected in Vedic ritual itself, where offerings to Rudra are never made within the sacrificial enclosure that is built for the sacrifices. If a sacrifice involves offerings to Rudra, the offerings will always be made outside of that, often sort of fairly far outside of that. And so Rudra in Vedic ritual itself is kind of the outsider, is the deity who's sort of part of the Vedic pantheon, but really kind of on the edge of it, and someone who's not so key to it. And this is how you, in a sense, this is sort of reflected in the way Shaiva and Vaishnava traditions then developed, because Vishnu is so strongly identified with ritual and with the world of Vedic ritual. The Vaishnavas can therefore say, well, we are part of this Vedic tradition, and the worship of Vishnu can be done through Vedic rituals. And what the Vedas teach is ultimately knowledge of Brahman in the Upanishads, who is identified with Vishnu in some of the Upanishads. And so, therefore, this is our tradition. And those ritualists who are merely performing rituals and don't look at these other texts, they don't actually understand what the Vedic texts really are saying, but we do. The Shaivas, on the other hand, as you can see, Rudra is not so central to Vedic ritual and to in the Vedic worldview. Therefore, they will see themselves as we don't belong to this tradition. They will accept the validity of this tradition, and in most cases, they will not say the Vedic tradition is sort of false or has no authority. But they will say what our traditions teach, what the Shaiva traditions teach, is vastly superior to the Vedic tradition. We do not belong to this Vedic tradition. We have a higher path that we pursue. And if you look at the way Shaiva traditions develop, it's kind of reflected in every Shaiva tradition in some form. This kind of comes in. And so this is why Shaivas will focus on the Agamas or Tantric Shaivas at least, will focus on the Agamas as their source of theology. There are some Shaivas who write commentaries on the Brahma Sutras, but this is much later. This is at a time when the Vaishnavas have made Vedanta a very prominent discourse, that you then have Shaivas who come in and say, let's engage with this as well. But in the beginning, they don't engage with these texts very much. They might cite a few verses here and there, but by and large, they don't really care about these. This is the source of their theology. Now, the Shaiva traditions, you might say, well, what about the Puranas? We've seen there are Shaiva Puranas. There are Puranas that talk about the importance of Shiva. Most Shaiva traditions really don't care about these texts. They don't engage with them. They don't cite them. They don't write commentaries on them. So you have Puranic Shaiva sort of streams, but these are not the dominant Shaiva traditions. The dominant Shaiva traditions are traditions that are not Puranic in their nature, and that will require you to become initiated into their tradition become a member of it through that. Now, you have two sort of main divisions that the Shaivas themselves make between sort of two forms of Shaivism. One is Tantric Shaivism, which we'll talk about today mostly. The other is an ascetic tradition that develops, which is often called the Atimarga, the higher path, the superior path. And it's a tradition of Shaiva asceticism that develops inspired or strongly influenced by the tradition of yoga that we'll talk about more later in the term, kind of the old version of yoga, and its theology is very similar to that. And it's a tradition of asceticism that sees itself as surpassing the asceticism that is taught in the Dharmashastras, for example, or in the Upanishads and so on. The notion of sannyas, of renouncing the world and becoming a monk. The Atimarga, the superior path of the Shaivas, they see themselves as superior to that, of a higher renunciation. That sort of, in a sense, does not deny the validity of this Vedic tradition in its broadest sense, but rather aims to transcend it and aims to go higher than that. The ascetic traditions, the Atimarga that develops, that kind of has its influence and so on, but ultimately the most influential traditions within Shaivism are the Tantric Shaiva traditions, and so that's what we'll focus on. The Tantric Shaiva traditions are basing their theology on the Agamas, as we mentioned. But they really come in two types, and you can sort of distinguish two ways in which two sort of tantric streams. And this is the distinction that's often made between, within the traditions themselves, between what is called left-hand tantra and right-hand tantra. And what they all have in common, what every tantric traditions, including the Vaishnava tantric traditions, have in common, is a basic understanding of the nature of this world. And if you think of back to someone like Shankara, for example, or someone like early ascetic traditions, which see the world as something that has to be overcome, the world matter is something that you have to rise above, something that you have to not be influenced by, and so therefore renunciation is important. You cease acting in the world, you perform acts of austerity in order to gain sort of control over the self and thereby not be influenced by the world. And so the engagement with the world in a number of ascetic traditions is mostly one of negation. You try to minimize your engagement in matter as much as possible while you have a body. Tantric traditions, on the other hand, say that there's nothing inherently wrong with matter. And the important thing is how you use matter, how you will engage with the body, with the physical material world that we inhabit. That is the key to attaining liberation or freedom in whatever way you understand that. And so the tantric traditions, both Vaishnava and Shaiva, will say that what you have to learn to do is use matter in the right way through ritual, and by using matter in the right way, you're able to transform matter into spirit, essentially, into the nature of the divine. And the reason for that is because tantric traditions see the world as an emanation of God, of the divine. And so the world is an emanation of the divine, and therefore is merely a transformation of the nature of the divine. We've seen Ramanuja kind of argued that in his theology as well. The world God is the material cause of the world, and the world is merely a transformation of it, which means that if you know how to use matter properly, you can bring it back to its source. And so you can transform matter into the divine nature of God.
When you say matter, is that referring to the person himself, like my matter, or is that stuff that you sacrifice matter?
Any matter. So the body is part of matter. The body is made of matter. So whether it's the body or just physical things in the world, and any of those. So what they will do is they will use the body in ritual. They will use material objects in ritual. But the understanding is that these objects and the body become transformed through that ritual. And so the most visible example of this is the worship of murtis in temples. So you construct an image of say Vishnu or Shiva. You build a linga of Shiva, the an iconic image of Shiva, and it's through ritual. That murti is made of stone or of metal or of wood, but then through ritual, during the consecration of that murti, that matter becomes, in sort of the tantric vision, becomes transformed in the nature of the deity that is worshipped through the murti. And so that the murti is no longer a stone or a metal, but is actually fully the divine. And so if you go to these temples, Vaishnava Shaiva temple, the murti is not sort of the image in the temple is not seen as an image of the divine, as something that represents the god, the deity that is worshipped, but rather as fully embodying that deity. And so everything that is done in the temple, all the rituals that are performed, all the worship that is done, is generally basically they're courtly rituals in a sense. They're rituals that consecrate the image as the king who rules over the temple, and the priests and the devotees at the temple are the attendants to the king in sort of the divine king manifested in the image in the temple. And so they really, for them, the murti is non-different from the divine, because the matter is transformed into something else. Now, this extends to other things as well. This extends to the body as well. And so before you engage in the practice of worship of the murti, you will have to transform your body into a divine body. As the tantric texts often say, you have to become a god before you can worship God. And so you have to become divine in order to worship the divine. And so you transform the body through the imposition of mantras, of deities actually, forms of the, you know, so for Vaishnava traditions, it is forms of Vishnu that will be sort of installed on different parts of the body, by which the body becomes then no longer governed by matter. It's the idea that which we've seen in Vedic text already, the idea that the different parts of our body are ruled by different deities within this world. So the eye is ruled by the sun, the mind is ruled by the moon, the mouth is ruled by Agni, by fire, and so on. And so different deities govern our sort of different bodily parts. And so what you do in the tantric rituals before you engage in the worship of the deity in the temple is you transform the body by installing different forms of Shiva or of Vishnu onto the body, which means that you now have a divine body that is not ruled by the different deities within this world, but that is ruled by the deity you're about to worship. And once your body has been ritually transformed as such, you can then approach the deity and then worship him, because you're living in sort of the divine realm during the ritual then. And so that's the basic assumption of tantric traditions, that matter in itself is not binding. It is binding, but it is not exclusively binding. If you use it properly, it can lead to freedom. And so the analogy that's often given in these texts is that if you have you walk barefoot somewhere and you step on a thorn and there's a thorn in your foot, you will use another thorn to sort of get the thorn out. And you know, if the thorn is kind of really deep in your foot, in order to sort of get it out, you take another thorn and you kind of dig it out, basically, sort of you pull it out. And so the thorn is the cause of the pain, but it's also the cause of the release from that. And so they say in the same way, the other example is, you know, the it's kind of in a sense sort of the principle of homeopathy. You know, poison kills you, but poison used properly can, you know, if you know how to use it, it can actually cure you. And so this is the basic presupposition of tantric texts. Now, there's a division, as I mentioned, between two types of tantric traditions. You have left-hand and right-hand tantra traditions. And the distinction between them is that right-hand tantra traditions are dualistic, whereas left-hand tantric traditions are non-dualists. And this means that they're dualistic in the sense that the right-hand tantric traditions are dualistic in the sense that they see there is a distinction between the individual self, between us and the divine and God. Even though, as we will see, they will sometimes use the language of non-duality, they see there's still an individuality that remains even in the state of liberation. And the individual self can never fully become divine, and there's always a difference there. Whereas the left-hand tantric traditions are non-dualistic in that they say there's only one reality, which is Shiva, which is pure consciousness, and everything in this world, including the individual self, are merely an emanation of that pure consciousness. And so what we have to come to do is realize that oneness of everything. They're more radical in their oneness than Shankara is, in the sense that they see the world also as an emanation of that pure consciousness, as sort of what kind of variously expressed, a sort of a condensation of it or a vibration emanating from it. That's the left. But they're also dualistic and non-dualistic in other respects. The right-hand tantric traditions, they will say that there's a distinction between pure and impure. There's a dualism, if you want, between pure and impure in ritual. And so during the performance of your rituals, you will only engage with pure substances, which means any offering that is made to the deity will be vegetarian. You will not consume alcohol. You will not consume intoxicants of any form. You will, be vegetarian. You will abstain from those sort of things. You will only use pure things in the ritual because there is a distinction that they make between pure and impure within this world. The impure things, they're the ones that bind you. The pure things, if they're used properly, they can actually lead to freedom. Whereas left-hand tantric traditions don't make that distinction, at least not in terms of ritual practice, and will argue that even impure substances, or particularly impure substances, when used properly in the performance of ritual, can actually lead to freedom. It's not that they argue that you don't make any distinction whatsoever in your engagement and sort of in your dealings in the world, but in ritual, there's no distinction between pure and impure, and you will use impure things. So you will make offerings of meat, you will make offerings of fish, you will consume alcohol in ritual, and ultimately this will lead to sexual intercourse in ritual. These are left-hand tantric traditions. Now, the Vaishnava tantric traditions, the Pancharatra texts, are right-hand. And there is, apart from a tradition that emerges in Bengal, influenced by the origins are a bit fuzzy, but it seems influenced by Buddhist tantric traditions and some Shakta and Shaiva tantric traditions that emerged there. There you, in Bengal, and kind of from the, say, 17th century onwards, you get a left-hand Vaishnava tradition that develops. But apart from that, all Vaishnava tantra is right-hand Vaishnava tantra. Whereas the Shaivas are really divided, and you have two strong traditions of both.
So the right hand duality, is that the same thing as Brahman and Atman?
Yeah, in the ultimate sense, they will say that there is individuality between. So you never lose. You never have to come to realize that you are actually divine. There is always a difference of some sort between you and God. In
so
right
hand
tantra.
Does the left hand tantric whatever say that there is no Atman at all? It's just a Brahman.
Yeah, in a sense, you could argue from the highest perspective. Yeah, it's realizing that you are non-different with the divine.
And they're saying they're calling Brahman Shiva.
Yeah, if in Shaiva traditions, yeah.
Does Vishnu have a similar role to Shiva, or is Vishnu like strictly part of that dualist? Where would Vishnu be in this equation?
In the Shaiva traditions.
Well. Yeah, I mean, where would they place Vishnu?
They would place Vishnu below Shiva, as the Vaishnavas do it the other way around. So it's a typical sort of Hindu attitude of you don't reject something fully, you incorporate it and just give it a lower position. With the one exception here, or one of the exceptions here, is that Vaishnavas, by and large, do not accept the authority of Shaiva Tantric texts. And most of them don't really comment on them at all. The few that do, like Madhva, for example, comments on has something to say about Shaiva Tantras, and he says, these are texts that are revealed by God to delude the demons. And so these are the texts that are kind of there to just kind of delude those and keep them away from the Vaishnavas. And give them something to do, but these are really they're Mohana Shastras. They're texts that deal with delusion. So they don't accept the authority of the Shaivatan. The Shaivas, on the other hand, and you have a passage on the handout there at the bottom of page one. It says there, you must keep this teaching secret. It is not to be given to just anyone, but given only to a disciple and to one truly devoted. Otherwise, one will surely fall into disaster. And then it gives the hierarchy. And it kind of, you see very clearly the way the Shaiva traditions position, Shaiva tantric traditions position themselves. They say, okay, the Veda is superior. The Veda is kind of, it's higher than just common life, normal life. But higher than the Veda is the path that worships Vishnu. The worship of Shiva is superior to the worship of Vishnu, and the right path, the right-hand tantric path, is superior to Shiva worship. So you have the sort of the common Shiva worship that is taught in the Puranas and so on. Higher than that is right-hand tantric Shaiva traditions. The left path is superior to the right, so this is a left-hand Shaiva text. So the left is superior than the right path, the right hand. The doctrinal path of Shaivism is superior to the left. The heart path is superior to the doctrinal, and there's nothing higher than the heart. The heart is basically the tradition that this text represents, the Kula tradition. And anyway, we don't have to bother too much about the specifics of the traditions above the left, but it's basically they see there's even within the left there's sort of a hierarchy of different traditions that are there. But you can sort of see Vaishnava tantric traditions, Vaishnava worship in general is kind of incorporated. It's just very low. It's even before the sort of Puranic worship of Shiva. The dominant. Okay, let's do this. Right. The most important, the biggest right-hand Shaiva tradition is a tradition called the Shaiva Siddhanta. Siddhanta is a term that's used in many sort of places. It means the anta, the sort of the conclusion that a siddha that is established. So the established doctrine of Shiva, basically. That's how the tradition calls itself. And the Shaiva Siddhanta is a tradition that today is still very much alive, primarily in the south of India, but is a tradition that actually originated in the very north of the Indian subcontinent, in Kashmir. And it's a tradition that emerges there there's a group of agamas that are sort of composed there that are dualistic in nature. So they talk about the dualistic in their theology, but also in their practice. And it is a tantric tradition. It's a tantric path, meaning that for the worship of Shiva is in the early Shaiva Siddhanta is the worship to attain freedom, but freedom in both of the senses that we talked about earlier in the term. So freedom in the sense of attaining liberation, but freedom also in the sense of obtaining freedom within this world, in the sense of gaining control of this world. And this is something very typical of Shaiva tantric traditions that you don't find in Vaishnava tantric traditions. Vaishnava tantric, the Pancharatra text, they're devotional texts. They will talk about the worship of Vishnu in a devotional way and so on for devotional ends. The goal is to attain union with Vishnu in sort of a loving relationship of devotion. These Shaiva tantric texts often emphasize the importance of attaining power within this world. And the worship of Shiva is a means to attain liberation, but is also a means to obtain things within this world. And so they talk about siddhis, powers, magical powers that you gain in this world, which basically gives you a certain sense of freedom in the sense that you can control matter in ways that you could never have conceived of before you started this. And so the notion of siddhis is something that goes back quite a long time. It's a notion that is found in many traditions, that engagement in the spiritual path will lead to certain magical powers. You can obtain things from another place. You can be in two places at the same time. You can become smaller than the smallest. You can become immensely great. You can become immensely heavy and so on. The exact number, there's generally said to be 8 powers you get. Exactly which what these 8 powers are differs from tradition to tradition, but that's kind of the things that emerge. Most traditions, at least most ascetic traditions, will say that these powers will come, but they're a distraction. And the earlier ascetic Shaiva traditions, the Atimarga, that higher path, they say that as well. They say these powers will come by the worship of Shiva, but you have to move on from that. If you get enamored by these and think, oh wow, now I've really made it, you've lost your chance for attaining liberation, and your entire life, your spiritual life, is ruined by being stuck at that level. And it's kind of sort of the final test of how serious you are about gaining liberation. The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali have a similar view. But in tantric texts, in Shaiva tantric texts, this is not seen as a negative thing. This is seen as a way in which you can, this is one of the outcomes you can choose. You can choose for this, you can choose for liberation. Either way, it's fine. So these tantric texts that emerged in Kashmir, they're sort of teaching this path of the worship of Shiva that can lead to either of those two ends, the attainment of siddhi, the attainment of liberation. But there's nothing intrinsically devotional about this. They're not devotional texts. They're not sort of worshipping Shiva for the sake of worshipping Shiva. They're worshipping Shiva for a certain motive. But then Shaiva Siddhanta becomes a very prominent tradition and spreads over the entire subcontinent and kind of is prominent for several centuries, but then dies out everywhere except in the south. And what happens in the south, in Tamil Nadu, is that when Shaiva Siddhanta reaches the south, it encounters another Shaiva tradition that existed there, a regional Shaiva tradition, and it sort of they merge, and it sort of the two streams sort of come together. And what developed in the south, in the Tamil speaking region, before Shaiva Siddhanta reached there, is a very strongly devotional tradition for Shiva, in praise of Shiva. And if you remember, we had the Alvars, which are these Vaishnava saints that Ramanuja drew on, this regional Tamil tradition of Vaishnava saints who sang in the praise of Vishnu in poetry. You have a similar tradition in there, the Nayanmars. And the Nayanmars are a group of, they're a larger group actually than the Alvars, but they're a group of Shaiva saints who lived in the Tamil region and wrote poetry in praise of Shiva, very devotional poetry, and you have a few on the handout, but we won't have time to read through them now. But they're writing these poetry in praise of Shiva in similar ways that the Alvars write in praise of Vishnu. And when Shaiva Siddhanta reaches that there, that tantric tradition becomes sort of fused with that devotional tradition of the south. And the Shaiva Siddhanta becomes a very strongly devotional tradition where the focus is the worship of Shiva, and the ultimate goal is the attainment of Shiva in the divine realm and the union with Shiva of some form. The Shaiva Siddhanta, though, retains its kind of tantric origins there, in that in Shaiva Siddhanta, if you receive initiation in the tradition of Shaiva Siddhanta, you receive the initiation that will lead you to the obtainment of those siddhis, of those powers. If you want to attain liberation, you have to take a second initiation, the Nirvana Diksha, the initiation into liberation. And only if you've received that can you then strive for liberation. Now, when Shaiva Siddhanta reaches Tamil Nadu and it merges with that devotional tradition of the south, what happens is that the Shaiva Siddhanta tradition becomes radically transformed and becomes very regional in many respects. And the most visible form of that is that you see a lot of Shaiva Siddhanta texts become translated into Tamil. A lot of the literature that is written by Shaiva Siddhanta teachers from that point onwards in the south is written in Tamil as well as in Sanskrit. And it becomes really a regional tradition fully embedded in that religious landscape of the south, focusing on the worship of Shiva in the temple and in many ways it is not too dissimilar from the other big tradition in the Tamil region of Ramanuja, the Sri Vaishnavas. One of the things that characterizes Shaiva Siddhanta from the beginning, but particularly when it reaches the south, is that Shaiva Siddhanta's thinkers, or the tradition as a whole, doesn't have a unified theology. This is something in great contrast to the traditions we've seen so far, where you know you have Ramanuja, he establishes a certain Siddhanta, a certain doctrine, that then is still taught by Sri Vaishnavas today, by followers of Ramanuja today, and the same with Madhva, and the same with Shankara. And the interpretation might change and so on, but basically there's a unity to the theology of those traditions. Shaiva Siddhanta is not like that. And it actually, over the centuries, you see it sort of shifting. Sometimes it's more Advaitin, sometimes it's more dualistic, sometimes it's Bheda-Bheda, sort of dualism and non-dualism. And you find different Shaiva Siddhanta theologians over the centuries teaching different things. And Shaiva Siddhantins have no problem with that. There's the basic sort of ideas remain the same, but the implications of it and the interpretation of certain things are different. And that's fine with them, because the Shaiva Siddhanta texts, the agamas that form the foundation for their theology themselves are seen to be teaching various paths and various ways of thinking about Shiva. The analogy that you get in the Shaiva agamas themselves is that this is a pile of jewels which all have their own light and their own colors and so on. Gems in Sanskrit have light, so... They all have their own sort of luminous nature and their own color and so on that's different from the others, and that's fine. They don't have a problem with that. And so what unites them mostly is the ritual practice, the practice of the worship of Shiva in the temple, the practice of the meditational practices that they have and so on. What they do have in common is sort of a basic vocabulary of thinking about these things and a basic idea of how how we should think of the world, and we should think of Shiva, and we should think of ourselves. And because they're drawing on very different texts than the Vedanta traditions do, they use different language as a result. And they will not talk much about Brahman and the Atman and so on, but they'll have different terminology. And the image that they use is of an animal, say a cattle, if you want, where we, as the individual selves, we're the pashus, the animals. Shiva is the pati, is the pashupati, the lord of the animals, and we are now bound by pasha, by a noose, by a rope. And so we're tied. We're a cow that's tied up somewhere at a post, and we're not free. And so we cannot move. We cannot sort of do much. And what we have to do is we have to obtain the Pashupati, the lord of the animals, which is Shiva, by cutting the pasha, by cutting the noose, the rope that binds us now. And that's kind of the terminology they'll use very consistently in Shaiva Siddhanta texts. And it's the way they argue we are bound is they say there's three things that bind us. We have karma, our own actions that cause us to be bound, similar to the way you have it in sort of Vedantic traditions. You have Maya, which for them is the world. Which binds us, which has a deluding effect on us, where we identify with matter. We see ourselves as our bodies and so on. But then they have this third category, which is fairly unique. Well, it's unique to Shaiva Tantric tradition, particularly to the Shaiva Siddhantas. It's very important for them, is this Arnava. And Arnava literally means minuteness. It's the derivative of the word Anu, which is the word that's used for atom, or sort of an indivisible particle. And they say we have this Arnava mala, this mala, this impurity of minuteness, and that is the last thing that we have to overcome in our quest for liberation. So we control our bondage to karma, to our actions. We learn to sort of see the nature of this world and therefore be free from the deluding power of the world. And then ultimately the last thing that goes is the anavam mala, the impurity of minuteness. And it's the impurity that causes you to not see Shiva, essentially. It's the impurity that causes you to see yourself as minute and to see yourself as separate from everything else. And they say when this disappears at the final stage, just before liberation, you're no longer bound by space and time, and you see the presence of Shiva in everything. You see the whole world as being emanated from Shiva, and you then can attain liberation. And which means that in early Shaiva Siddhanta texts, they often talk about what happens when that anavamala is removed, that impurity of minuteness is removed, is that you become a Shiva, as they often talk about it. And this is not too. This is you have the same in the Ati Marga, in the ascetic Shaiva traditions before this. They have a similar notion that when you attain liberation, you become a Shiva. You don't become Shiva, but you become like Shiva in nature, in the sense that you're kind of, you know, not limited by space and time, except for five important powers that are unique to Shiva, which is the power to create the world, to maintain the world, to dissolve the world, the power to reveal himself, and the power to conceal himself. Those are the powers that are unique to Shiva, which you can never have. But in other respects, you become like a Shiva, you become a powerful being, no longer governed by that impurity of minuteness, and you attain the divine realm where Shiva is and where you are. As the Shaiva tradition, Shaiva Siddhanta tradition becomes more devotional, it becomes more, it starts to emphasize more that yes, you become similar to Shiva in nature, But you're still there's still some sort of dependence on Shiva. And so earlier Shaiva Siddhanta texts don't sort of talk much about this, but later the devotional traditions start to emphasize that, well, even in the states of liberation, you are in union with Shiva, and you're like Shiva in nature, but you're in union with Shiva, and there's some sort of dependence there, although they don't like to talk about dependence, because dependence is a state of bondage for them, unlike the Vaishnavas. Now, in order to obtain this, the Shaiva Siddhanta tradition says grace is immensely important, because we are the cow that is tied to a post, and we cannot sort of untie the rope. But if the owner of the cow comes and cuts the rope, then the cow is free. And so grace is immensely important for them, in the sense that the Shiva helps us to become free from that bondage and attain him in the divine realm. As I said, though, particularly for the early Shaiva Siddhanta tradition, liberation, unlike the Vedanta traditions where liberation is the goal, you want to attain liberation and be in union with Brahman in however you want to conceive of that. For the early Shaiva Siddhanta, that's one of two options. The other option is just attaining siddhis, attaining powers within this world, and there's nothing wrong with that. As the Shaiva Siddhanta tradition becomes more devotional, that sort of part is slightly kind of, you know, downplayed, but it's still there, and it's sort of still remains a way they think about it. Does that make sense? Let's leave the left hand for later. Don't want to squeeze it in the 1 minute that we've remaining. So I'll just open for questions. But just to keep in mind, just to sort of summarize, the Shaiva traditions, very different foundation for their theology and ritual practice. Their foundation is the Shaiva Agamas for the Tantric Shaiva traditions. The right-hand Tantric Shaiva tradition of the Shaiva Siddhanta is a tradition that emerges in Kashmir, but really develops in and sort of is still alive in the Tamil region, where it mixes with an existing devotional tradition. Anyway, that's kind of, if you remember that, then that's good.